Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Rev Midnight Black Mass, a production brought to you by GeorgeWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you discussions and interviews with figures of entertainment and general pop culture. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Midnight Black Mass.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Midnight Black Mass, and tonight we're very proud to have our
industry, and a very important one in my opinion. So very much looking forward to that. We got the Muji Movie Minute coming up here for you later with 1985's The Stuff and a couple more that he happened to drudge up in the darkest recesses of the compound. A little wrestling news and recap before we move on to other things. Of course, that's the reason we're here. This is the Georgia Wrestling History Radio Network, and you are live on the Midnight Black Mass. As I mentioned in WA Chattanooga, that was January 20th, last Friday, in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee. And my man, the Deadly Sin 7, in the main event, went toe-to-toe with a strong style Psycho Tank in one of the damnedest fights I have ever laid my eyes on in 12 years of professional wrestling. These two monsters beating the snot out of one another, beating the life out of one another almost, tied together with a 10-foot-long steel chain, dog collars around their necks. There was no disqualification, no count out, and only the truly baddest man would survive. And I'm sorry to say that it was not the Deadly Sin on this night. I would very rarely, even in a situation like this, you know the Reverend, you know how I handle my business, but even in a situation like this, I would rarely, if ever, give accolades where they, when someone defeated one of my talents, but the Strong Style Psycho Tank, he proved to be one hell of a fighter in that match, and it'll go down as probably one of the best big man matches I've seen in quite a while. The Deadly Sin's going to rest. He's going to take a little time off, but we're going to game plan together. We're getting a new training regimen together. He's going on a new diet. He's getting focused. He's getting angry. He's getting mean, and he's coming back for you, Tank. You have not heard the last of the Deadly Sin. I can promise you that. Aside from that, it was a big night in Soddy Daisy. There was a lot of festivities. They had the NWA Scenic City Hall of Fame with great legends like Joyce Grable and Pat Rose, Ricky Morton. Even some local Chattanooga media legends were on hand for that, and like Don Welch and Bill Reyes from old News Channel 9 here in Chattanooga. Very, very astute honor to be a part of that event. NWA Chattanooga returns February 17th. Will the Deadly Sin be there? Who knows? You'll find out if you show up. Deep Southern Championship Wrestling, another NWA affiliate, coming up down in Fannin County, Georgia, at Fannin County High School next Saturday night, February the 4th. Going to be a big card. I'll be reuniting with my boys, the Hate Junkies, the most dominant tag team in all of professional wrestling today. And we will be wreaking havoc as we do in just the LJ Blue Ridge, Georgia area. Make sure you get there early. That event does tend to sell out. On to the music news. Had a few big album releases this week, or a couple at least. Lacuna Coil, female-fronted Italian metal band, has a new album called Dark Adrenaline. A lot of people, if you remember the popularity of Evanescence, I was not a fan of that band myself, but this was actually the band that kind of originated that whole sound of the heavy band with the angelic female vocals over the top of it, and they still do it better than anybody for my money. So, you know, you want to check out that album, Dark Adrenaline. It just came out this week. Also, Lamb of God, the thrash metal Kingpins out of Richmond, Virginia. Their new album, Resolution, you have heard the new single that's out on the radio here on the Midnight Black Mass as well, Ghost Walking by Request. We'll have that again for you later tonight. The band Rat is back in the studio, set to release another studio album this summer. The last album, Infestation, came out in 2010 and was very well received for a band that many of you might just be a nostalgia act. A lot of folks want to go out to the concerts and they want to see these bands, but they don't necessarily want to hear the new stuff. So very, very important, impressive for Rat to put out a new album in 2010 that people are digging. It really is a quality effort with most of the original lineup intact, so I can only imagine that this new album hopefully will have some of the same vigor and venom. News on Black Sabbath, of course, we reported to you sadly that Tony Iommi has been diagnosed with lymphoma and has relocated to Birmingham, England, actually. And we found out now that the rest of the band, Black Sabbath, has done the same, all back to where it started. They're to be there with Tony while he gets his treatments, and they're still apparently recording this new album that's coming up. So just impressive perseverance by the men that invented it all in terms of heavy metal, Black Sabbath. That's good to hear. Good to hear. A bright light in a dark, cloudy situation in terms of Tony Iommi's cancer. But fans, we're moving right along with the show tonight. Told you we had Ghost Walking coming up, the new single off Lamb of God's Resolution. That is still coming up later, along with a whole lot more tunes. But right now, we're going to move right along. We're going to get down to the Muji Movie Minute. Now this week, it's Muji and he's got the stuff. Won't you tell us a little bit about the stuff, Muji? What was it? Where'd you find it? How did it smell?
All right, Rev. We got the stuff. It's another Netflix classic that we found on there. A 1985 movie directed by Larry Cohen, also written by him. He did a bunch of other kind of low-budget horror deals. Basic premise for the movie is that some guys find some mysterious ooze-type things that shooting up from the earth, and a big company decides to just plumb it out of the earth, stick it in some cartons, and sell it as the stuff. The big deal, the main plot of the movie is there is a character called Mo, who is a corporate guy who goes around trying to figure out what's going on in the other places. He's kind of like a detective. He's a saboteur. He's going around investigating the stuff because it's taken over. He works for like an ice cream company that can't keep up anymore. And then there's another kid who kind of figures out the stuff is bad for him, and their stories cross. The basic whole movie is they start investigating the stuff, find out that the stuff is evil, and do their best to get rid of it. That's all I'll tell for the plot. The movie was pretty entertaining. It's horrible, but it's horrible in a great way, where all of it was hilarious. You got some famous people. You got Paul Sorvino from Goodfellas in it. You got Danny Aiello from Godfather in it. Some people who obviously
it had nothing to do with the mob.
No. Some guys who obviously just took a paycheck in this movie because they were acting just as goofy as the movie was. The good highlights from the movie are there were tons of good little one-liners. Probably the best thing is that there were three separate, like, fake commercials in the movie with different jingles made for the stuff, and they were all pretty hilarious and pretty 80s sounding awesome. So those were some of the good highlights. Like I said,
and I scoured the internet for those songs to play, but unfortunately, they're as rare as that film, I do believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I thought it was quite entertaining. Like I said, it's horrible. It's just awful, but it's still very, very entertaining. I can only hope. Parts of the movie are just so ridiculous, and I mean, you gotta be. This is like, it's a fun movie, but you really gotta pay attention to even figure out what's going on because it just goes from place to place. You know, they end up getting a general to help them out with like this army. I think it said, you know, the best way I could describe it was like Halloween 3 meets Star Wars meets a big, you know, bucket of shit. But it's still funny, and it's hilarious. I would love to see a gag reel because just some of the stupid things that happen in here, you'd have to imagine that the people in the movie just had so much trouble keeping it together. All the dumb
things. And fans listening at home, you know, we talked about Shark Knight 3D the last time we were here on the air, and we just lampooned it and almost felt bad about how badly we spoke of that film. But here's an example in the stuff going back to 1985, a movie that was terrible, but in all the right ways, whereas Shark Knight 3D, terrible in every conceivable way, no redeeming qualities whatsoever.
Yeah, and I give it a 60% well done. You know, there's nothing really in particular good about it. The acting's bad. The lines are bad. The special effects are really bad. They're really behind their times, but it was funny. It makes you, a lot of the laughs aren't even intentional, though some of them are, but it's definitely a good time. Definitely a movie that you could sit down and watch again.
Yeah, and you cannot overlook Garrett Morris's performance as Chocolate Chip Charlie, which was the highlight of the film to me in many ways.
Yeah, he was pretty funny in it for sure. There was a lot of good stuff, and Yeah, that's about all I can say. It's so awful that I can't think of anything in particular that I really liked about it, other than it's just really funny and it's, you know, straight out of the 80s, so it still feels good even though it's horrible.
It very much is. They might have mentioned the stuff. Looks like it could be marshmallow fluff or jism, perhaps, or yet somehow by the end of the movie, you and I were both wanting to try some.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, moving on from the stuff, we got a few more minutes here before we get our special guest, Jason Aaron, coming on at 1:30 here. But I understand that was our group viewing for the week, but I do understand that you had a couple of other solitary finds that you stumbled across. What do you have for us, brother?
Yeah, let's see. I'll just talk about one more. Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. I checked that out. It's from 2011. It was written and produced by Guillermo del Toro, even though he didn't actually direct the thing. Starring Katie Holmes and Guy Pearce, who are both good, who I like a lot. Basic premise of it is Guy Pearce is an architect. He moves into a house with his girlfriend, who's played by Katie Holmes, and a little girl played by a chick named Bailey Madison, who did a good job. And the house has got some creatures that live inside of it. And basically the whole movie is the creatures are trying to talk to the little girl, trying to get her to come down to the basement and into this little shaft type thing to take her down underneath this old house so they can eat her, is what they're getting at. And it's her basically trying to tell them that the monster's there and them not believing them. It was pretty disappointing, I thought, overall. The good things, Katie Holmes was good in it, and the little girl, Bailey Madison, was really good in it, I thought. Guy Pearce, it was not the best thing he's ever done. And the things I didn't really like about the movie were, it looked really good. You know, the cinematography was good. It looked cool. But one thing is they kind of give away the monsters and, you know, basically what they look like really early into the movie. And they also start, the little girl has interactions really early in the movie to where the rest of it just seems pretty implausible. Like a guy that's working on the house goes downstairs and these little monsters like stick like scissors and knives and things into his head. And when they find him, they just think he had an accident. So it really takes you out of the movie. You're like, nobody would stay in this place after that happened. And then the little girl keeps having crazy things happen to her, like her animals are getting torn to shreds and, you know, all this. And even like with 30 minutes to go in the movie, they see the little monsters and have a chance to escape, but hang out and decide they're going to try to get rid of them, which is something that no one would do. So the rest of the movie just seemed kind of implausible. So it just, you know, kind of, you know, took you out of it from there. They just kind of ignored all of the really bad things that were obviously going on around them. So actually, I gave it 55% well done. I thought it looked great, and there was some good acting in it, but it was just so unrealistic that, you know, it couldn't be scary, like, whatsoever.
And what about that, folks? 1985's The Stuff, which was probably produced on a budget of about 75 cents and a hot dog, gets a 5% higher rating than a Hollywood big-budget picture starring Katie Holmes. Only here on the Midnight Black Mass, folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Muji. Well, that was another edition of the Muji Movie Minute. Any idea what we're looking at next week? Any suggestions? Any thoughts?
Yeah, next week we're definitely going to check out The Innkeepers, which is a new movie from this year that's available right now on video on demand. It was directed by Ty West, who also did a movie we reviewed last year, The House of the Devil, which was a really good find on Netflix. It was entertaining. He also did Cabin Fever 2, which, remember, we liked just because it was funny. And this is his next thing that's come out. So two in a row that we liked, The House of the Devil because it was really good, Cabin Fever 2 because it was funny. So we'll see how this one plays out, but pretty excited to check it out.
Yeah, the Cabin Fever 2 was worthwhile just for the Judah Friedlander line of, hey, man, this water's bullshit.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
All right, Muji. Well, there you have it. There's another edition of the Muji Movie Minute. We'll see you next week, brother.
All right, see you next week.
Goodbye. And as we move right along, we're going to play a few tunes for you as we move into 1:30 with our special guest, Jason Aaron. a comic book writer extraordinaire. For the moment, I want you to head over to Amazon.com, type in Lamb of God Resolution, only $9.99. You can go over there and pick up your copy today. Right now, we're going to give you a little taste of that just to ensure that you purchase your copy. This is the brand new single off of the new Lamb of God album that dropped this week, Resolution. This is, by request, Ghost Walking.
Yeah. shade to black is where I come from. Depression, misery, and hellacious fun. No, we're not the kind to turn our backs and run. There's three shades of black is where we come from. We are a certain breed and we don't like you. Some are junkies, some are freaks, and others are everyday ghouls. No one will ever know what we've been through, and we are proud in the light of the moon. Three. Cause the darkness gives us our thrills. Black is where I come from. I was born into sacrifice when I was young. Three shades of black is what makes us strong, and we all wear it like a uniform of chosen ones. Three. The darkness gives us our thrill. Cause the darkness gives us our thrill.
Fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling
at the Academy Theater in Avondale State.
We're also at the Masquerade every month or so.
Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling.
And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of Rad. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. And remember, don't drink and drive. It's just not worth it.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Rad, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hey, parents. Introducing the Communicizer. Go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
I love you, Dad.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Hi there, I'm Tim McGraw. One of the great things about music is how it brings people together. Kids like to hang out, listen to music, and talk about what's hot and what's not on the music scene. And playing instruments and singing provides a way for young people to get together and interact in a cooperative and respectful way. Kids who play in school ensembles understand that every part has to work together for the result to be the magical art called music. Your local school music programs provide a golden opportunity for your child to experience the rewards of learning music. Why not pay a visit to the music teacher to find out what's going on? Get your kids involved with school music.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, Gibson Musical Instruments, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. Music, part of a sound education.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
and that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Hey, baby!
This is what you have to do to make me love you too. God, dance with me, Henry. Dance with me, Henry. Rock with me, Henry. Talk to me, Henry. Dance with me.
Okay, fans, thank you for joining us here. We're back on Midnight Black Mass. You heard the second part of a double dose of Hank 3 there early in the show. That was Long Hauls and Close Calls and Three Shades of Black, both off of the Damn Right Rebel Proud album. You also heard some Gideon Smith and the Dixie Damned, former guests, both of them actually, here on the Midnight Black Mass. That was the song Ghost Rider off the album Southern Gentleman. And, of course, you heard the new Lamb of God single, Ghost Walkin'. Unfortunately, wouldn't be Blog Talk Radio, would it, if we didn't run into some sort of technical issues, and that's what we're having right now with our guest, Jason Aaron. I'm hoping to still get him on tonight. If we can't work it out, we'll hope to reschedule something. Big bummer if we couldn't, but he's a very accommodating dude, just a very busy one. So if we can't get him back on the show tonight before we're off the air, hopefully we'll have him back on in the future. We're going to move right along with things right now, fans. We're going to move along to a little segment I like to call TV Casualty. Back with another edition of TV Casualty, looking at Batman the Animated Series in the context of the DC Animated Universe. This is the first in many series that were put together to form one cohesive animated television universe. This started back in 1992. Our episode this week is POV, stands for Point of View, as many of you porn fans will know. First air date originally was September 18th of 1992. Was directed by Kevin Altieri and written by Mitch Bryant. We see in this episode the first appearance of Detective Renee Montoya, notable because she later went on in DC continuity to become the female version of The Question. And fans, it looks like we may have a guest on the line at this time. Just one moment. Yes, 913 area code. You are on the Midnight Black Mass.
How's it going, man? This is Jason Aaron.
Oh, Jason, welcome, my friend. So sorry. Had a little difficulty getting you on there, but you are live now on the broadcast, and it's a pleasure to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me on. Sorry I was a little late.
Oh, no problem. Hey, you know, never know how things are going to go when you're live, man. But first of all, Jason, we know you're a busy man as a freelance writer. We know your time is precious. We greatly appreciate you sharing some of it with us. Of all here, the ghouls in the late night on the Midnight Black Mass, to give us a look behind the beard. So let's get right to the meat of things. Big things happening for you right now in the comic book world, man. You are currently writing Wolverine, the X-Men, the Incredible Hulk. You're taking part in a huge crossover event coming up with X-Men versus the Avengers. I know, just reading your columns and things, that you grew up a comic book fan. How does it feel to be sitting in that spot right now?
Well, of course, it's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I've been a comic book fan since I was a little kid. Actually started out probably as more of a DC fan than a Marvel guy. But Marvel was, you know, the company that gave me my first big break as a writer, I guess about 11 years ago now. So, yeah, I mean, it's awesome. I get to stay home and make up stories for a living and actually get paid to do it. It still kind of boggles my mind sometimes. You know, whenever those chicks show up with Spider-Man on it, I'm still a little surprised. but, yeah, I mean, it's been a good couple of years for me. I'm very happy, you know, with what I'm doing at Marvel. And I think, you know, this year in particular is going to be a crazy one for me. I've got a bunch of the stuff I've been doing for a few years now wrapping up. And a bunch of new stuff, you know, kind of getting underway. Avengers, X-Men, obviously the biggest one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk about that more in detail here in just a moment. Let's just take a look at a couple of the things you're working on right now. What about the Hulk? You know, that's a character, just my opinion, that I thought has been a bit overexposed in recent years. I thought there were some really good stories in the midst of all that. They've just kind of been all over the place. So I was extremely excited to hear that you were taking the reins on this title. What can we expect in the coming months from the Green Goliath filtered through your twisted consciousness?
Well, you know, if you've read the stuff so far, I think we're on issue 4 or 5 is the most recent one. I forget. But it's all been kind of a building towards the full-on Hulk versus Banner throwdown. You know, the issue number one opened with the two characters split apart, and we still don't really know how that happened or who was responsible. It's kind of, you know, being filled in slowly as we go along. And the arc that's going on now is, you know, those two characters for the first time really going at it and, you know, physically in the real world. I mean, we've always seen Hulk and Banner fighting inside their, you know, their minds for control of the same body. Now we see them literally trying to kill one another in the real world. You know, and that battle will have a very clear winner and loser, and ends explosively, quite literally. And you know, it doesn't you know, smooth things over and set things back up again, and everything's hunky dory. You know, the way this arc ends is just another you know, strange twist of the screw in the lives of these guys. So things aren't going to get you know, all rosy for the Hulk anytime soon.
Yeah, and that sounds like an absolutely amazing journey. And you know, as you'd mentioned, we always know the internal struggle between the Hulk and Banner, but now you're giving us the external struggle, and I'm really excited to see where that goes. I'm the biggest X nerd on the planet. The Rev grew up a small wee child in the 80s. Addicted to the Chris Claremont stories, then through the big boom of the 90s with the cartoon and things. And I've got to say, just personally, what you're doing here with the Wolverine and the X-Men and even back to the Schism event, it's some of the most exciting stuff that I think the X-Universe has been faced with in a while. Can you take us through the journey of having to do that, of having to break up the X-Men?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you're digging it. It's great to hear that people who are like longtime X fans like what's going on. You know, it seems like we've also brought some people who haven't been checking out X Men lately into the fold. I think there's a lot of good textbooks right now. I mean, I'm having a lot of fun with what I'm doing, but Kieran Gillen's Uncanny X Men I think is great, and Rick Remender's Uncanny X Force, you know, in particular, I think are two really, really good X books, and I think between all the X-books, you've got very different kind of books. So you don't have to read one to understand the other. They're, you know, I think things connect together, but it's not completely interlocked to where, you know, you have to read everything. You can pick and choose, and I think get very different flavors of X-books. But, yeah, Schism was something that had been building, you know, in the X-universe for quite a while, even before I was really involved. But once I got involved, I really gravitated towards that story. I think it, for me, it made a lot of sense as an evolution for Wolverine with all the stuff that I've been doing. You know, I've been writing Wolverine really as long, literally as long as I've been in comics now. The first story I ever did was a Marvel Talent Search contest, which was a little Wolverine story. And since I came back to Marvel and have been working there full time, I've been doing Wolverine stuff that whole time. So I think all the stuff I've done with him, I think it all makes sense that this is kind of what the point he evolves to. Some longtime X fans, I think, were a little wary about the whole idea of Wolverine, you know, splitting from Cyclops and opening a school. They wondered, you know, is this me trying to neuter Wolverine or you know, take away the edge that people have always loved about him? But hopefully people see that that's still there. You know, he's a character who's always really gravitated towards that younger generation of X-Men, being protective of some of those characters, you know, with Kitty Pryde and Jubilee, and, you know, now we see that with Ivy, and to me that all flows together with him being headmaster of a school. Not to mention the fact that I just think it's a lot of fun to suddenly put Wolverine, you know, in that Professor X role and watch him really struggle with that. I mean, it's not something he's used to and not something that's easy for him, you know, which makes for good character drama and hopefully the kind of X story we haven't seen before.
I do think that it would be just, like, especially because I have been following the Wolverine story since you've been on board with him, and it is like it's the natural evolution of the character, and you've got a great voice for Wolverine, and I think it's part of that southern thing that you mentioned, being originally from Alabama. There's something about that really clicks with Wolverine.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, for some weird reason, even though he's, you know, the character's Canadian, he certainly, over the years, has developed that kind of, I don't know, some kind of down-home grittiness, and, you know, there's a lot of a spaghetti Western hero in him, like the Clint Eastwood man with no name kind of stuff. So he's, you know, not to mention all the Japanese and Asian connection. So the character is like a real oddball mix of stuff. But yeah, it's one I certainly enjoy writing, and hopefully, you know, I've been able to develop a voice for him that people like.
And here's something that I want to ask about, because it coming from the wrestling side of things in my career, I've worked in the capacity of what we call a booker, which is the closest thing that we would do to what you do, which is crafting things that would play out in stories that eventually would have a culmination. And you do get attached to the things that you create. And I know as a writer, you have to get attached, especially somebody like Wolverine or just the X-Men in general. After writing them for so long, you've got to feel like they're close to you or a part of you. I mean, even reading them for so many years, but then writing them later, did it just tear your guts out as much as it did mine? The final fight between Scott and Wolverine and Schism, just as a longtime fan, it was killing me. So I know having to be the voice of those characters, it had to take a toll on you, right?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of fun for me. Yeah, I mean, that's the good stuff, you know. Or maybe that speaks to me being emotionally flawed in some way, but that's the stuff I get excited about, you know, or working on the scalp that I do, the creator-owned book, you know, the stuff that at times is the most disturbing or emotionally troubling, you know, that's the good stuff. Like you like diving into that as a writer, and, you know, later you can look at it and say, oh, that was kind of awful and depressing. But, you know, I get emotionally charged writing scenes that are emotionally charged, whether they're disturbing or funny or, you know, action packed or whatever, just if it's got a charge in it, like, you know, that's good stuff. That's why you do this job. So yeah, the Schism just in general was a lot of fun to write.
It's just raw and it's real, and that's the true passion of what any artist does coming out in their work. And as you said, it's the high point when you can achieve it no matter what. But moving on, you know, two titles that we know are near and dear to you here, we've discussed on the show a few times, in particular, Punisher Max, which we know is wrapping up, as well as your creator-owned title, Scalps. Do you care to give reflections just on those in terms of their importance in your career?
That sounds lofty when I try to put it that way. certainly two books I've, very close to my heart in terms of all the stuff that I've done. Punisher Max, that book's kind of an oddball, I think, in today's comic book market. It's one big story over the course of, 22 issues, I think, by the same creative team, which was awesome. A lot of those guys kind of had to make sacrifices to be able to stay on that book. It's not exactly burning up the sales chart, but it's one of those books kind of like Scalp that people who respond to it, seem to respond to it strongly. And I think that the last issue of Punisher Max is still, we still have one more to come out. And I don't know, I'm interested to see what people think about it.
I'm anxiously awaiting it.
Hopefully it's a Punisher story you've never read before. I don't want to spoil what happens. If you've read the previous issue, you kind of know where it's headed and what's going on. But I'd just say this was always the plan from when I first took over the book, from when we started with Punisher Max number one. This was always where things were headed. And that actually there was a subway ride to Coney Island that I was on with Axel Alonso, who was the editor on the book back then, is now editor-in-chief. And I kind of told him over the course of that subway ride, it's a long-ass ride across Brooklyn. Brooklyn's huge, I found out. So I told him the whole spiel, from issue one on to the end, this is what I want to do, and he let me do it, and now we're finally here, and it's one of those things that's a little weird. It feels like I've been writing that book a long time, just like with Wolverine, and it's fun to when you have a big story like that to get to the end and hopefully stick the landing and maybe you're a little sad when you look back and say, oh, that was fun, I'll never get to do that again, but there's always something else to move on to. And then, Scalped is the same way. Scalped I've been doing for five, six years now. So it'll be 60 issues by the time it's done, which I'm really proud of, because when issue one came out, nobody knew who the hell I was. I was fresh off the banana boat, just coming out of nowhere. I was just a guy working at a warehouse in Kansas City who somehow stumbled his way into comics and, doing a book about a Native American crime drama. It's not exactly something that people were banging on the doors of comic shops, demanding more of.
But right.
Now right. Where are all our Native American crime dramas? But somehow we were able to get 60 issues out of it, which is, I think, something to be proud of.
And if I'm not mistaken, both of those ended pretty much on your terms. You'd explained the Punisher Max, but also the Scalp. Is that something that you'd planned it to go that long and had ended it, or you just kind of found a stopping point and decided you were going to go there? How did that come about?
Yeah, the Punisher Max, that was always intended. This is one story, and this will wrap up. Scalp was the same way. I never knew exactly what that issue number would be. I always said when we were around issue 30 that we were about halfway. So that worked out to be exactly. So there were, there were some stories that I always thought I would get to in Scalps that, we could have kept going, but you think at some point, you want to try to end on a high note. You want to go out when people still enjoy the book and you don't want to overstay your welcome. So certainly once we started getting towards the end, I wanted to kind of build up momentum. I've always loved doing the standalone issues. I did a lot of standalone issues over the course of Scalp, but once we started getting closer, I just wanted to do big arcs and, try to wrap everything up on a big note.
it's certainly gotten a buzz about it. I've had a lot of recommendations for that. Scouts is not one I've gotten around to yet, but I'm definitely hoping to pick that up in the trade paper format. As far as Punisher Max, it's really disappointing to know that the sales weren't good for that, because I did my part at least. I owned a couple of the trade papers on that one. That Kingpin copy that I have is so worn, I've shopped it around to all my friends saying, you know, you've got to check this out. You've become a big hit in the NWA wrestling locker rooms across the country, I'll tell you that.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. And, you know, I mean, it's a book that sells well. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's not selling as good as, you know, the Wolverine or the superhero stuff that I do. Just because, you know, it's mature readers, crime book. You know, Marvel doesn't really do too many Max books right now. So, which again, I think makes it all the more special that the whole team was able to stay together and that, you know, Axel gave me the leeway to do exactly the kind of story that I wanted to do. And I think it's a Punisher story that, you know, it's pretty evergreen. I think you can pick it up 5-10 years from now and read it, and then, you know, it hopefully still be an enjoyable story that stands on its own.
But just the rise of the Kingpin in the beginning of it sets up everything so perfectly, where he's, you know, it's a brutal, but it's sad and gritty and exciting all at the same time. It's just a real story of the lengths a guy's going to go in his rise for power. And just from the idea of the Kingpin being a myth and Wilson Fisk coming in and just usurping that role blew me away, and that was a lot of fun, man. So thank you for that excellent work.
Well, thanks. I mean, the idea of using the Kingpin was actually Axel's idea, because, you know, I mean, I had to follow Garth Ennis's run on Punisher, which to me is the run on that will define that character as long as there is a Punisher. That was my favorite run pretty much on any Marvel book of the last several years. So to follow that was really intimidating. And I knew I couldn't come in and try to do the exact same kind of stories Garth had done. So it was Axel's idea of saying, why don't you do a Max version of the Kingpin? So I jumped on that and I said, well, that's great, but if we're going to do that, we have to do a Max version of Bullseye too, which was a lot of fun figuring out, you know, what that character would be in the Max universe, where he can't be the guy who, you know, flicks toothpicks and stuff and kills people. But he's still got to be the assassin who never misses. So making him that kind of like a profiler where he could get in somebody's head, you know, even Frank Castle's head, and figure out ways to get at him, that was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, and the fact that he was batshit crazy, that did translate over to the Max universe, especially the part where he abducts the family and is, you know, I'm Frank. That just blew me away.
Right. Well, you know, it's certainly just a lot of fun to write batshit crazy, especially in Max, where, you know, there are no limitations. I can kind of go as far as I wanted to go. But the idea that, you know, there's something about the Punisher's origin that it doesn't make sense as it's laid out. You know, you start trying to figure out, when exactly did he become the Punisher? Did he become the Punisher that day in Central Park when his family died? You know, if you read some of the good stuff Garth did about Frank's time in Vietnam, you see he was pretty much that guy before his family died. So, you know, it doesn't all fit together, and that's what Bullseye started to bang his head against. So he started trying to recreate those circumstances and find the family and have them killed right in front of him. So I like the idea that he just appeared on the surface to be just absolutely insane, and his methods were ridiculous and over the top. But then as it goes along, you find out, oh, he's actually really good at what he does, and he actually gets into Frank's head like nobody ever has.
Yes, absolutely. And fans, can't say enough positive things about Punisher Max. Go out there and pick up your copies. There's trade paperbacks of every volume except for what's coming out now in the final arc, so you definitely want to pick that up. I know there's probably not a lot you can say at this point, given that we're not into it, but Avengers versus X-Men, we touched on it earlier. That is a motherfucking dream match that has only been teased within a few times, you know, never on a scale this epic. So just added to my pull list today. What, if anything, can you tell us about this coming up?
Can we use that as a cover blurb? A motherfucking dream match?
Absolutely. I would be honored.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's what you expect. It's what the title says. It's Avengers versus X-Men. It's a big superhero brawl. It's an epic story. It's 12 issues, three acts, and each act is a big escalation of the story. You know, there's no real-world metaphor like, you know, we've done with some of our events in the past. This is just Marvel's two biggest franchises beating the living shit out of each other. But a story where you've got both sides with really defensible positions. You know, this doesn't come out of the gates with the X-Men as the villains or the Avengers as the villains. I think X-Men fans will be able to root for the X-Men, and Avengers fans will be able to root for the Avengers. You know, and if you're somebody who is not reading either one of those franchises, it's still a book you can jump right into. Everything you need is contained within that book. You know, and the simple pitch is, you know, these aren't just Marvel's two biggest comic book franchises. These have obviously become their two biggest movie franchises. And then we've seen, you know, Marvel's movies all building up towards the Avengers that comes out this year. And, you know, X-Men has been a very successful franchise for Fox. So this is the only time you can see those two franchises come head to head. And even, you know, even if we could make this movie right now, to make this book into a movie would be about a, you know, you need about a $6 billion special effects budget. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you can get away with in comics. Like, we have an unlimited budget, you know, especially when you're working with such amazing artists. Like, if you can get them to draw it, you know, you can do absolutely anything that comes into your head, which obviously you're a little more limited in Hollywood. So this is like the full-on balls-out biggest, you know, Avengers versus X-Men fight you could ever possibly imagine.
That's everything I was hoping to hear. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, it wouldn't be a $60 billion special effects budget, but, you know, the only limitations there are the artist's ability and imagination and your storytelling, and I think any fans that have been following know that there's really not a lot to worry about in that respect. But, you know, just moving along to some various other topics here before we wrap up, I really appreciate you joining us again. The first thing that I read that you were writing was back on the Wolverine Weapon X title. I actually then went back and read the Ghost Rider thing that you did, which that right there was one of the things that made me start following you. First of all, the Ghost Rider, because he's always had trouble finding a voice that I thought fit him, and I thought that, you know, doing the Blaze and Catch in that Heaven's on Fire thing was really cool. But Wolverine Weapon X, I was reading it, and there's a scene where Wolverine is stumbling out of a bar, and he's singing some Hank Williams Senior, and I thought that was cool as shit. Because, you know, Logan Paye, he was probably alive while Hank was around crooning. But then, of course, I also came to find out that you're a fellow Southerner. I'm here from Tennessee. You're just right down the road in Alabama, or now you're in Kansas City, but you're from Alabama.
Sure.
You said you write in a Southern style and that it helps your voice stand out. And that's awesome because, believe it or not, in pro wrestling, it's kind of a bad thing to be Southern if you can wrap your brain around that. But on the flip side of that, have you experienced any sort of discrimination in the comic book industry due to being from the South, beyond good-natured pig-fucking jokes?
Right. I get a lot of those from Rick Remender, you know, who lives out in California. He loves to make the hillbilly pig-fucking jokes. No, I mean, I've never felt discriminated against or looked down upon. I mean, I think, if anything, I think it's helped me. You know, these days you can break into comics from anywhere in the world. It's not like it used to be where you had to move to New York because that's where all the publishers were. You know, I work with artists who are literally all over the world. You know, in Scalps, the creative team on Scalps, we live in four different countries, you know, between the group of us. So I think as a writer, it helps to be from some place where
you know, not everybody else is from. I think it gives you a voice that stands out a little more. And there aren't a lot of, you know, Southern writers and comics, not very many at all. I mean, Mark Waid is actually the only other guy I know who's from Alabama. But, you know, I mean, he grew up there when he was real little, but I don't know if he'd call Mark Waid a Southern writer. I think
right.
He probably spent more time in the South than he did. So, you know, in my mind, that has helped, and that it does make you stand out. You know, not everybody needs to live in New York or California. I love country music. I hated it when I was a kid. I used to be horrified when my dad would watch Hee Haw. I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen, and now I record it on my DVR so I can watch it.
That's really funny because that's the same way. You know, I'm more of a metalhead myself, but in my old age, you know, you go through life's trials and tribulations, and country music somehow identifies with you a little better as
sure.
You've experienced a little more life.
Sure. And I love being from the South. You know, there's a lot about it that I don't like, but I wouldn't change anything in terms of growing up there. You know, I like Kansas City. I like where I live. We have better barbecue than in the South. I have to admit that. But you know, I consider myself proud if somebody would think of me as a Southern writer. I think that's great.
Very good.
And I grew up on a lot of Southern wrestling too. I remember we'd get wrestling probably out of Atlanta. But I remember, like, Bob Armstrong was one of my favorites. And remember there were like, a couple of different guys who would dress up like Lord Humongous from Road Warrior, which
I thought
was the most awesome thing ever. Even though the dude looked like he was probably about 6'2 or 6'3. It's not like he was a giant, but he'd still kind of push the rope down to step over it when he'd come in the ring. Like he was massive. But I thought that was the coolest shit I'd ever seen.
That is great. I've been all over that Alabama territory and in Atlanta. That's, you know, another place where I've done most of the television stuff in my career. And going back, you run into all those old legends out on the circuit doing appearances. I've worked with the Bullet Bob Armstrong like 15 times. He's the coolest old fella you ever meet. Smokes about 2 packs of cigarettes before he goes out of the ring and could whip everyone in the building's ass at 80 years
well,
old. Still.
Yeah, still. Yeah, I'm sure he could beat my ass. yeah, I remember there was one point where for some reason he got banned. He had to leave the wrestling. And then suddenly this dude showed up who was just called the Bullet, who was wearing a mask. So they're like, Bullet Bob Armstrong had disappeared, but now the Bullet's back and nobody knows who he was. Like, that was good stuff. I ate that shit up with a spoon.
That's great. And unfortunately, a lot of that is lost on the modern corporate version of wrestling with WWE, but that's another rant entirely
sure.
That you did. You got to experience some of the true good Southern wrestling.
Right. I find that there are a lot of comic fans among wrestlers, and there seems to be like a lot of wrestling fan, comic fan crossover. I'm sure you could write a paper about, you know, just the similarities between wrestling stories and superhero stories. There's a lot there, but there certainly does seem to be a lot of cross-pollination.
Oh, yeah. A lot of actually over in TNA Wrestling, which is on Spike TV every Thursday night at 9 o'clock, a couple of their big stars, Christopher Daniels and AJ Styles, we have the same agent and kind of came up around the same folks. They're huge comic book fans. I think Daniels has even done some guest like voiceovers for the little Marvel action figure videos they do. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Well, man, we're wrapping up here on this interview, but it's been an awesome insight into the world of comic book writing. I greatly appreciate you again joining us. The last thing I'll ask you about here to talk about, we did mention that you grew up as a comic book fan. So you are living your dream, and kudos to you for that. But in the lines of most entertainment work like this, we do it because we love it. from that medium, what inspired you the most in terms of old comics that you grew up on? What were your favorites as a kid that made you want to pursue this even further?
Well, the first book I really fell in love with that made me a comic fan, the first book that I would, I had, like, where I had to get every issue of that was the Wolfman Perez New Teen Titans. Because I was a big DC guy when I was a kid. That's how I got into comics. And I was the perfect age for that book, and that was, you know, great rip-roaring, full-on superheroes action. George Perez was the first comic book artist whose work I could recognize. You know, when you have one of those guys and you can just look at a cover and say, I know who drew that. Like, that's a big thing when you start to be able to recognize different artists. So,
yeah,
that book was big, but then, you know, after that, I discovered Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, and that was huge. And then Grant Morrison's really the guy who I knew, like, I want to do that. I want to do what he's doing. Because he really kind of blew up what people were doing with mainstream superhero books. And I would still say he's my favorite comic book writer of my life. But, I think it's a... It's a great time to be a comic book fan right now, I think. You know, as a writer, you look back to the early 90s and you hear the stories about, you know, the guys who would sell 6 million copies of a comic and, you know, buy a house off of one issue of an Image book. So
wow.
You think, man, like I missed the heyday in terms of the money and the business side of things. But I think creatively, you know, there's no comparison. I think... these last few years, are far and away where I think we're putting out better comics as an industry. In mainstream comics and in independent books, I mean, you know, times are hard for everybody. And, you know, it took a little longer to catch up to comics, but it certainly has. And, you know, we've seen Marvel have to let people go. We've seen people struggle to... you know, to get sales for independent and creator-owned books. So, you know, things aren't necessarily that rosy, but I think creatively, you know, you've got a lot of creators out there really firing on all cylinders, doing good work.
Yeah, and not to plug the competition, but of course I guess it's too much competition since Scalp is with them, but, you know, with the new 52 thing that DC is doing, it seems to have generated a lot of interest, so I hope that translates over for everyone, whether it be Marvel, DC, or independents, to a bunch of new comic book fans, because I agree with you. I think there's so much stuff to choose from out there right now that it really could appeal to any type of comic book fan. I've got like 6 or 7 titles that I'm going with monthly now, and there's so much more that I want to get that just, you know, the budget limits.
Sure. I think there's good stuff inside the mainstream, and there's good stuff out. I think it's a shame that to the normal person, when you mention comic books, they think superheroes. That they think that one genre is really representative of the entire medium. If you want to make a living doing comics, you pretty much have to write superhero books. I mean, that's what, you know, dominates the sales chart for the industry, but. There are a lot of great books outside of superhero comics as well. So, I read stuff all over the map. I read a lot of the New 52 books. I'm friends with some of those guys like Scott Snyder and Jeff Lemire. You know, I think are doing awesome work over there.
Man is crazy.
It's crazy,
Jeff,
right?
Lemire.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a small industry. Everybody knows each other. For the most part, everybody gets along. It's a good time to be working in comics.
Awesome. Well, on that note, my friend Jason Aaron, thank you again for joining the Midnight Black Mass. We greatly appreciate you taking us into the world of Marvel and DC Comics. If you're ever at Dragon Con in Atlanta, I know you don't do a lot of the cons, but... hit me up. We'll have a few brews. I usually only have to work one night at the con, and the rest of it's just pure debauchery. So we can
do that.
Pair it up.
Dragon Con was the first convention I ever went to. I would go every year back when I lived in Alabama. But yeah, I haven't been back in a while, but I'd love to come back.
Well, absolutely, and I would like to see you down there, man. Well, take care of yourself. Best of luck in the future, and thank you so much for joining the broadcast.
All right, thank you, man.
Thank you, Jason. See ya.
All
right, fans, that was Jason Aaron of Marvel Comics, one of the freshest voices in all of the industry. Fans, we just got ourselves an edumacation in the world of comic books from one of the top writers in the game, taking his precious time to join us here on the Midnight Black Mass. Outstanding. We're going to go to some more music. We're going to be back with TV Casualty. Just a little hiccup there, but we picked it right up along, and we're moving it for you, and we'll wrap up the show with that. Right now, we got our good buddies Unspoken Triumph, who the Rev will be in attendance live at their concert this Tuesday night at JJ's Bohemia in Chattanooga, Tennessee. This song is off of their Vindication album. This is called The Berserker's Prayer. And again, you just heard Unspoken Triumph with the Berserker's Prayer off the album Vindication. You can actually go and download that at www.unspokentriumph.bandcamp.com. You can name your price. They'll even let you have it for free. That's right there at that website. You can get your copy of the album Vindication if you're in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area this Tuesday night, January the 31st, JJ's Bohemia in downtown Chattanooga. $5 cover and $1 beer. You can't beat it. It's a metal massacre, a face-melting metal massacre indeed, as the Unspoken Triumph will be rocking out Chattanooga in the scenic city. And that was a great interview we had with Jason Aaron, Muji Movie Minute with the Stuff, as well as Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Been a great edition of the show. When we thought we were having technical issues and we didn't think Jason Aaron, our special guest, was going to make it, we started in to this segment of the show. We abruptly dropped it to accommodate the guest, so now we're going to just pretend like that didn't happen. So join me right again for another edition of TV Casualty. And that's right, we're back with another edition of TV Casualty as we round out this edition of the Midnight Black Mass. This is our inside look at the DC Comics animated television universe, starting with Batman the Animated Series. And we're moving right along, folks. Episode number 7, called POV. It aired originally September 18th, 1992. The episode was directed by Kevin Altieri, written by Mitch Bryant. A notable appearance here is the first appearance of Detective Renee Montoya, who later went on in DC Comics fame to become the female version of The Question, the faceless gumshoe of the DC universe. Excuse me. Basically, the story of this, Detective Montoya and Officer Wilkes are speeding to a warehouse location where they're attempting to drop off a robbery or to get the stop off a robbery that's about to take place. Once they arrive, they notice the building is engulfed in flames with Harvey Bullock lying passed outside. Just then, two criminals climb out of a broken window and make their escape. Wilkes chases after them while Montoya heads in the warehouse to see if anyone is left. And Harvey Bullock's fat ass is being rescued by Batman. Bum, bum, bum! Excuse me there. The story skips ahead. The three of them are then being interrogated by Gotham City Internal Affairs and Commissioner Gordon. They want to find out what went wrong, and Montoya blames Bullock for not waiting on him. Bullock insists that they were late in arriving. Each of them are then asked to tell what happened, thus the POV point of view. The purpose of this show is to see how much the story changes when you get three, even honest, perspectives involved. We come to find out that maybe not all of them are so honest. As Detective Bullock's flashback reveals, he went into the building early in an attempt to get the jump on the criminals and probably take the credit as they were trying to steal the money. Bullock accidentally kicks a can. This alerts him to his presence, bumbling around there. After fighting some of them off, of course, Bullock is attacked by a crazy criminal wielding an axe. Why not? He makes the man miss, but the axe does strike a power box, which then causes an electrical fire, and the whole building is engulfed in flames. As the criminals escape, Harvey is left trapped there in the fire. And just as he's about to die, Batman swoops in and leads Harvey Bullock to safety. However, according to Harvey Bullock, he was the one who saved Batman after it cost him the chance to catch the criminal. There's one point of view that's slightly skewed already. Next is Officer Wilkes. He's the rookie on the scene. He's the next to tell his side of the story. After arriving at a warehouse and he chases two criminals down a dark alleyway, a car emerges from the back of a truck with men inside it. The car speeds towards Wilkes as he tries to run away, but instead trips and falls over. And just as he's about to get it, pow, right in the kisser, Batman lands in front of him and causes the car to crash over into this building. Once one of the men tries to escape, Batman throws a batarang at him, knocking him over. He then leaps over the man, and according to Wilkes, the criminals mention the word Doc. Wilkes has a very fantastical perspective of viewing the Batman. He says, you know, he didn't throw ninja stars at him, which he did. He shot sparks from his fingertips. He's watching this from the shadows. Batman is larger than life. Throws a batarang at him. He doesn't even see it. He says he just hold out his hand, and the villain falls to the ground. And then the Batman leaped over him. And, of course, the criminal again mentions the word Doc. What does that mean? That's our first clue. And we're going to get Renee Montoya's side. She's the last one. She basically heads inside. She encounters two of the remaining criminals. One of them throws a suitcase of money at her and then charges at her with a power drill. Renee was saved, though, by Batman, of course, as he came down from the ceiling and KO'd the two goons. The roof then began to collapse above them from the raging flames. Renee nearly gets crushed, but Batman pushes her out of the way at the last second, sacrificing himself, leaving him trapped under the burning rubble. Switch over back to Gotham City Police Department. Hackle, the internal affairs representative interrogating these officers, doesn't believe any of their stories, and he orders for immediate suspensions on all three of them. They each have to turn in their guns and badges. On the way home, Montoya figures out that Doc, the criminal was referring to, was actually the docks near the water. So getting off the bus, Renee follows the clue to Hathcock Shipping Company, where she finds Batman tied up, hanging from the ceiling. And she, of course, uses a little jiving with a lockpick. She opens up the back door and sneaks inside. Batman asks one of the criminals where their boss is, and one of them points to the ship located behind him. Feeling satisfied with this information, Batman takes a knife out, and he manages to free himself from the suspended rope over the ceiling. After knocking out a few of the guys, Batman attempts to free his hands from the rope, and another criminal pulls out a gun. Montoya is able to sneak up behind him and knock the guy out, though. Suddenly, gunfire starts raining down upon them, so Batman uses the grappling gun to fly them up to a crane not too far away. Tells Renee to stay while he goes back down to fight. Montoya captures the crime boss. She then uses the crane to drop a box on three criminals attempting to attack Batman. Leader of the group heads inside the ship as it begins to pull away, and suddenly a criminal behind Batman charges at him inside a forklift. Batman is able to knock him off, and he takes control of the forklift himself. Batman runs it off the dock, crashing it into the ship. Begins to take in water, and soon crashes nearby. With the criminal boss attempting to escape, Montoya uses the crane claw to drop it down on him, trapping him inside. Criminal group stopped in their plans. Montoya, Wilkes, and Bullock all get their badges and guns back from the Gotham City PD, get a pat on the back from Commissioner Gordon, and they're once again part of the crew. Of course, all the usual suspects appeared in terms of voice actors here. Kevin Conroy is Batman, Bob Hastings is Commissioner Gordon, Robert Costanzo is Harvey Bullock, and we introduce Ingrid Olieu as Renee Montoya and Robbie Benson as Officer Wilkes. Very, very interesting episode. No major Batman villain. It was just a simple tale using the three perspectives and showing the various skews and opinions against Batman and the police force, from the ones that fully support him to the ones who are fully behind him, like Harvey Bullock, fully against him, rather, like Harvey Bullock. So that's what we got next week. The Forgotten is our Batman episode. We're going to find out that Bruce Wayne discovers that homeless men are being abducted and used as slave labor for a very fat man on a very hot farm. And that's next week on TV Casualty. And fans, that will wrap it up for another edition of the Midnight Black Mass. Thank you very much for joining us. We had a great edition with comic book sensation from Marvel and DC, Jason Aaron, talk about all of the world of the visual medium that we love so much here on the show. Got a little wrestling news, got a little music news, got some great tunes, you got Muji on the Muji Movie Minute. What else can we give you? Oh, yeah, we can give you Motorhead to say goodbye. This is the classic, only released as a single originally, later added to compilations of various accord. This is the legendary Motorhead and Lemmy with Kill by death. We'll see you on the dark side. Fail me again, Admiral.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production. Nation brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.